The Tom Woods Show, episode 2073.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, I don't know about you, but I am running into a lot of progressives saying, look, police, fire, schools, these are all great examples of socialism. Well, let's focus on that school example. I've got a free ebook called Education Without the State that makes a pretty darn good case for a stateless approach to education. Pick it up at nostateeducation.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. We want to talk today about what's going on in Missouri. The Department of Justice is challenging a bill that became law in the middle of last year in Missouri that, let's say, challenges the ability of the federal government to carry out federal gun regulations in that state. We're going to get into the details of that in a minute with one of the people who played a very significant role in getting that bill drafted, and that's Dave Rowland, who's the director of litigation and co-founder of the Freedom Center of Missouri. You can check it out at mofreedom.org. I'm going to have him tell you a little bit more about himself in just a minute, but this is the kind of topic that, of course, interests me because I did write a book called Nullification back in 2010, and that's exactly what Missouri is up to here, more or less. So, Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I'm glad Michael Bolden connected us here. It's very interesting what's going on in Missouri. Before we jump into this, though, can you give me a little bit of, I know the basic gist of your background, but can you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to be knowledgeable in an area like this?
Absolutely. I was raised in a family that loves the Constitution, that loves our nation's founding values. And when I was in college, I took a class in constitutional law, and it just immediately spoke to me. And I knew that this was kind of my calling, where I needed to focus my energies. So I went to law school at Vanderbilt, got my master's in theology while I was there as well, had a couple of fantastic clerkships with groups like the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, in the Institute for Justice, and that clerkship with IJ turned into a full-time job. That was my first job out of law school. So, you know, I cut my teeth very early litigating property rights, economic liberties, free speech, issues like that. And then I met and married a girl from Missouri, and we started our organization, the Freedom Center of Missouri. And we've been litigating in state and federal courts here for about the past 10 years or so.
That's very interesting because most people who go to law school do not come out of it supporting the kind of thing that Missouri is trying to do here.
That's true. Yeah. Even those who go in there with good aspirations sometimes have them beaten out of them.
Right. Or it seems hopeless because they feel so alone in holding these views. Well, first of all, tell us about exactly what House Bill 85, signed into law last June, seeks to do.
Well, it's very simple. It works on two levels. The first is it seeks to educate. It starts with a preamble that kind of reiterates the foundational principles of federalism on which our entire constitutional system is supposed to be based. And it makes certain statements about the General Assembly's understanding of the limits to congressional power. And those limits include that they're not supposed to be able to create national firearm laws. This was the kind of authority that the Constitution, as originally written, left to the states, and Congress has usurped state authority by proposing or purporting to pass these federal firearms laws. And so the Second Amendment Preservation Act says, look, we think that these laws are invalid, and this state intends to treat them as invalid insofar as we're not going to assist in their enforcement. Now, crucially, the Second Amendment Preservation Act does not prevent any federal officer or agency from enforcing federal law. If they tried to do that, courts likely would strike it down as violating the Supremacy Clause. But as long as the Second Amendment Preservation Act extends only to prevent state and local police officers from assisting in the enforcement of these unconstitutional laws, it's perfectly legitimate, perfectly constitutional within our federalist system. So we first proposed this bill, I believe, in 2012. Matter of fact, I think you and I might have met about that time briefly at the Missouri Capitol when you came to speak to the legislators about federalism. The bill was originally passed by the legislature in, I believe, 2013, and then vetoed by then-Democrat Governor Jay Nixon. it kind of percolated over the next several years, but the legislature wasn't really motivated to pass it while there was a Republican president. But once Joe Biden was elected, all of a sudden, the urgency of the Second Amendment Preservation Act became a lot more clear, and they passed it, and the governor signed it this last year.
Has it had any practical effects so far?
Yes. So one of the effects that it's had is that you've seen a lot of these state and local authorities discontinuing their collaboration with the federal government, particularly in the context of multi-jurisdictional drug task forces, which, although they are theoretically supposed to focus only on the enforcement of drug laws, in fact, they were actually doing a lot of firearms law enforcement as well. And so you've seen a significant rollback of local involvement in these task forces. You've also seen some local officers declining to assist in the prosecution of defendants in federal firearms accusations, federal firearms prosecutions. So there have been very clear and direct effects from the Second Amendment Preservation Act being passed. And what's funny to me is that a lot of the screaming and hollering that you hear from folks opposed to this bill hold up the fact that you're seeing decreased participation in these task forces, decreased participation in federal prosecutions as something bad or negative. I mean, that's not a bug of this law. It's a feature. It was part of the reason that the Second Amendment Preservation Act was adopted in the first place. And so I'm very pleased with how it's being implemented thus far.
Are they saying, the other side, are they claiming that the federal government has a right to the cooperation of state and local authorities, that in effect they can conscript them into their service?
Yes and no. So the argument that the U.S. Department of Justice has put forward, and to be clear for listeners, SAPA has been challenged on two levels. The city of St. Louis and St. Louis County and Jackson County, which is where Kansas City are located, they filed a lawsuit in state courts, and that went up to the Missouri Supreme Court, and we're currently awaiting a decision, which could come as soon as this Tuesday. So that's one level. And then the U.S. Department of Justice filed a lawsuit in federal court last week or the week before, all basically arguing that SAPA violates the Supremacy Clause. So the U.S. government is arguing not really that it has a right to have state and local law enforcement officers assist in the enforcement of these laws. In fact, in their complaint in the federal court, they acknowledge that states can withhold that assistance if they want to. What they're basically saying is they feel like the federal government is being discriminated against. It's kind of a weird argument. It's one that I don't think I've seen before, and I don't think it's likely to prevail, but that's what they're arguing. At the state level, the cities and these counties are arguing primarily that it violates aspects of the Missouri state constitution. They're saying it violates the separation of powers insofar as the legislature says, hey, we think these things are unconstitutional. And they're saying, oh, well, if the legislature says this, then courts are bound to obey what the legislature says, and that's a violation of separation of powers. It's not true. It's an illegitimate legal claim, but that's what they're putting forward. So the legal challenges, we knew they would come because those who like the idea of maximizing the power of the government are always going to throw a fit and do everything that they can to try and prevent measures like this, which limit the scope of the government's authority. But again, that's part of the reason why the Freedom Center has been involved in this issue from the outset, is we wanted to draft a bill that we felt like had a very strong likelihood of being upheld in the courts, while also drafting a bill that was likely to have the kind of effect that we've discussed, that actually does limit the federal government's ability to implement these unconstitutional laws.
Suppose I'm reading what Merrick Garland says. The United States will work to ensure that our state and local law enforcement partners are not penalized for doing their jobs to keep our communities safe. Well, of course, the phrase doing their jobs to keep our communities safe means collaborating with federal authorities pursue their ends. So is there a provision in House Bill 85 that says that if you are a state and local law enforcement person and you do assist the federal government, that you will indeed be penalized in some way?
No. So one of the things that we did with the bill was we didn't want the penalties to flow against the individuals. We wanted the penalties to flow against the law enforcement agencies that are employing them. So there's no prohibition against a state or local law enforcement officer assisting in the prosecution of a federal firearm law. But if they do that, the law enforcement agency that employs them can be sued and they're subject to a $50,000 civil penalty. So again, it's not the individual that would be the defendant. It's not the individual who would be paying the civil penalty. That would go against the agency that employs them. And by the way, this is perfectly consistent with Missouri constitutional law. Article 1, Section 3 of the Missouri Constitution specifies that the police of this state must always be subject to the authority of the people of this state. The people, acting through their legislature, have said, we do not want our state and local agencies or officers to assist the federal government in this way. And it is our right under the Missouri Constitution to impose that kind of a limit, just like it's our right under the Supremacy Clause to make the decision that we're just not going to comply with these unconstitutional federal laws.
Hey, everybody, just a heartfelt word of thanks to Skillshare, the online learning community that has been so good to the Tom Woods Show and is sponsoring this episode. They're offering our listeners a 1 month free trial. And man, can you accomplish a lot at Skillshare in 1 month with thousands and thousands of classes on fascinating topics like illustration, design, photography, animation, productivity, and a lot more. I am going to be trying out, with the little bakers I have in my household, cookie decorating for beginners. Create incredible edible art with Laurie Shannon. So many possible areas of enrichment, so many wonderful new things you can learn to do and add a bit of joy into your life. And whether you're a dabbler or a pro, a hobbyist or a master, there's something for you on Skillshare. They've got classes for every skill level. They have short lessons, hands-on projects, and classes designed for real life. Explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/woods, where our listeners get a 1 month free trial. That's 1 month free at Skillshare.com/woods. I guess one of the arguments the Department of Justice is making is that this bill is invalid under the Supremacy Clause. You knew they were going to try to make that argument.
Oh, of course.
That one you hear all the time, and you hear it generally from, forgive me, law school graduates or people just repeating arguments they heard elsewhere. If you read the entire Supremacy Clause, you see that it doesn't apply. So how would you answer the claim that the Supremacy Clause, let me just specify, the way they say it, the way they summarize it on TV is, quote, federal law trumps state law. It does not say that.
Right. So there are two ways that we have to consider the Supremacy Clause. The first is the way that it was originally drafted. It was understood when it was drafted that the Supremacy Clause does not empower the federal government. The authority of federal law is conditioned upon that law being validly adopted in the first place, it being a valid exercise of congressional authority. And as you and I both know, congressional authority is limited to those powers enumerated in the Constitution. So the understanding of the Supremacy Clause at the time was that if Congress exceeds its proper authority and enacts a law that it, by all rights, it did not have the power to enact, then the Supremacy Clause doesn't apply. Now, part of the problem is that over the years, the courts have basically abdicated their responsibility to check the power of Congress. And they have essentially decided to rubber stamp almost any law that Congress passes. That's a problem because now this one important aspect of the Supremacy Clause for the court's purposes is taken out of the game. And so the next question is, well, does the state or local action actually prevent federal officers from enforcing federal law? And what we've seen through the anti-commandeering doctrine over the last couple of decades is that the Supreme Court's been really good about saying, well, look, if you're not actually preventing federal officials from enforcing federal law, you're not violating the Supremacy Clause just because you're withholding assistance. And that's what Merrick Garland has chosen to overlook in these lawsuits. He's basically acting like the mere fact that the state has decided not to make it easy to enforce federal law, not to assist in the enforcement of federal law, somehow violates the supremacy clause. And that's just not accurate, either as a statement of the original intention of the supremacy clause or as the U.S. Supreme Court has applied the supremacy clause over the last couple of decades.
Right. And that's the key thing, is in terms of whether you're going to prevail or not, is how they interpret it. It
yes.
doesn't really matter with, unfortunately, what the original intent.
Yeah, and that's one of the struggles that those of us who are educated in principle, public interest attorneys, we have to recognize that the way that the courts are likely to see these issues is not necessarily in line with the original understanding of these provisions. And so we're in the position of, we know what the historically correct arguments are to make, but we also have to recognize that bringing those historically correct arguments isn't necessarily a recipe for winning your litigation. And so we have to kind of adopt approaches and perspectives that allow us to get the result that we want, while at the same time accounting for the fact that the courts have not always been principled or historically accurate in the way that they've applied these provisions.
Right, because of course, for me, the most important part of the Supremacy Clause is the in pursuance thereof wording.
Right, yes.
So if the law is not in pursuance of the Constitution, then the Supremacy Clause does not apply. But if you bring that up, then that gets you into the thorny issue of, well, who decides if something is constitutional?
Right.
And they'll turn around and say, the federal government decides if it's constitutional, and we've told you that it is constitutional,
right.
What we're doing with guns. So it's not up to Missouri to make that decision. So then then you're arguing 19th century federalism. Again, even though we're right, it just seems like you have to do what you have to do to win, make the kinds of arguments that are most likely to succeed. So what's the next step here? So the Justice Department files this lawsuit. Is this like with civil suits, they take, 50 years finally to be resolved? Or do you have a timeline? What happens next?
So it could take that long, probably not 50 years, but it's not unheard of for cases to take 3 to 5 years to work their way through the courts. Under certain circumstances, cases can be expedited. That's what happened with the state-level proceedings in Missouri. The trial court rejected the municipality's arguments pretty quickly, and then they had the option of direct appeal to the Missouri Supreme Court. So we're going to end up with a decision from the Missouri Supreme Court probably pretty quickly. That's not necessarily going to end the litigation, but that's kind of in the weeds to explain why. But in the federal level, I would expect that you're going to see a response from the state. And I think we're probably going to ask for a ruling from the district court pretty quickly. Now, I will say the U.S. government got kind of a favorable draw as far as the judge is concerned. And so it's possible that they end up getting a favorable decision from the district court judge. But then we're going to go up to the Eighth Circuit. And I feel like the Eighth Circuit is probably going to do the right thing and reject the federal government's arguments here. Then the question is, is it the kind of thing that the U.S. wants to take to the U.S. Supreme Court? In other words, do they want to make their supremacy clause arguments to the U.S. Supreme Court, or will they be content to just accept whatever decision is handed down by the Eighth Circuit? Maybe they want to push it to the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't think that would be wise with the current makeup of the court. Basically, what I'm saying is if they want to take it to the U.S. Supreme Court, I invite them to do so, because I think with the current makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court, we would likely get a pretty good supremacy clause decision. Not what you and I would think is the historically correct decision, but a decision that more or less gets us a good result, even if the reasoning is not completely what you and I think would be proper. Does that make sense?
It absolutely makes sense. I could very well see them losing in the circuit court and then saying to themselves, cases that wind up in district or circuit courts, they have their effect, but most people, unless they really follow stuff like this very closely, never really wind up hearing about them. However, Supreme Court cases, they get national attention, people debate them and talk about them. Do we really want to risk this decision that was just handed down in the circuit court being in effect codified as the Supreme Court's semi-official view of the Supremacy Clause, or do we just take the L and move on?
Right. That's kind of the catch-22 government litigants sometimes find themselves in. We saw, for example, in New York, where they got decisions favorable to the government in the Court of Appeals on some of these Second Amendment issues, and then the plaintiffs asked the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case, and the Supreme Court did, and immediately you saw the government doing everything possible to prevent a ruling on the merits from the U.S. Supreme Court. They bent over backwards to try and make sure that you wouldn't get kind of that definitive ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court on these issues. And I think that's probably what we're going to see from the Department of Justice here. I really think that they're just filing this lawsuit more for public relations than anything else. If you read the complaint from the attorney, frankly, it's one of the weakest complaints I've seen in quite some time. And so I don't think they actually expect to win. I think that they just felt like they had to do something to try and put a shot across the bow of these other states that are considering passing something like the Second Amendment Preservation Act. And there are other states that are getting in this game that are looking to what Missouri's done as a model, which is a good thing. It's part of the reason why we drafted things the way that we did, is in hopes that other states would look at what Missouri's doing and decide to stand up as well. That's what James Madison pointed out that he thought should happen in, what was it, Federalist 46, where he talked about when one state kind of stands up to an improper exercise of federal authority, other states would feel the pressure and the motivation to do the same, and that he viewed as a potential check on the power of the federal government, right?
Well, and that's another reason I don't think they want to risk an unfavorable Supreme Court decision, precisely because it emboldens other states.
Yeah.
Because they've heard what the Supreme Court is going to tell them, and they know that it's favorable to them. So now they go ahead and proceed. I think they just, again, if they lose in the circuit court, they just have to take it. Can you verify something for me? I have been told that the federal judge who will be is married to one of the biggest opponents of the law from the state house. Is that so?
Well, certainly a vocal opponent. Yes, Judge Lowry is married to Chris Kelly, who is a former member of the General Assembly. He's also a former Missouri state judge. And he has been vocally critical of the Second Amendment Preservation Act. A couple of people have raised the question, well, does this mean that Judge Lowry should perhaps recuse herself from this case? And I don't think so, honestly. I mean, I did note earlier, I think that Judge Lowry typically tends to have a more favorable view of the government. And in this case, it would be the federal government, not the state government. But at the same time, I do not think that the fact that she's married to Chris Kelly is a basis for having her recused herself from this case. I mean, the fact of the matter is sometimes attorneys marry each other, and sometimes they even end up on opposite sides of issues. And we don't just assume that because someone is married to somebody who holds one view, that the spouse is necessarily impacted by that view. So yeah, it is true that Judge Lowry is married to a vocal critic of SEPA. I don't think that that's likely to mean that she steps down from the case or that she should be required to.
I understand you did a great deal of the legal heavy lifting in the version of the bill that passed. Is there anything about the history of that process that, if you were to recall it, we would find interesting?
Yeah, well, I think so. So we first started tossing around the idea of SEPA in about 2012. And one of the things that we felt really strongly about is, as I mentioned earlier, we wanted it to be educational as well as effective. And so we talked about this preamble, and we wanted the General Assembly to make this statement of these principles of federalism, because a lot of people don't know this. A lot of people don't think carefully about the relationship between the federal government and the state governments and the proper limits on congressional authority. And we wanted the bill to kind of provide this educational process. And so I went back and I dug in to the writings of James Madison, Thomas Jefferson. I even leaned a little bit on Alexander Hamilton to talk about these founding principles of federalism and have that as part of the preamble to the bill. Now, the funny thing is both the municipalities that have challenged SEPA and the U.S. Department of Justice have tried to put stink on this part of the bill by saying, oh, well, this is the ghost of John C. Calhoun and racism and slavery. And it's just historically illiterate. And I actually said that in the brief that we filed at the Missouri Supreme Court. I said, it's historically illiterate. Here are the sources for these statements. They come from the father of the Constitution. They come from the Federalist Papers. They come from Thomas Jefferson. And they're not some radical pro-slavery idea. They're statements that identify the proper balance of power in our federal system. And I also pointed out, I love pointing out the personal freedom laws that were passed in opposition to the Fugitive Slave Acts that Congress tried to pass in the early 19th century. And I said, SEPA is far more like the personal liberty laws that were direct responses to the evil of slavery. So don't try and paint this as some kind of racist neo-Confederate perspective. This is a pro-liberty perspective, and it's been used for pro-liberty causes since the beginning of the Republic. And it's the kind of thing we should be celebrating, not trying to tear down.
Well, agreed. I've absolutely agreed. And isn't it funny? You get the same idiotic pushback every time you raise these arguments. It's always John C. Calhoun, which goes to show, always, number one, either they're just lying, or number two, they just don't know anything. And I, by the way, I think it's possible that's a combination of the two. They don't know any of this material.
Yeah.
I found that when I would go speak, I have spoken at several law schools on this topic. Now, what a lot of law professors know very well is some key cases from the 19th century. They know those cases and they know John Marshall really well. Yeah. But what they don't know are the ratifying conventions, the documents that I discuss in my book, Nullification. So I know that if I walk in there, I don't have to worry about anything. That is the place on earth where I feel the most secure. Nobody's going to call me on anything because nobody knows it. I was at Columbia Law School and I stood in front of a packed audience. You could not fit one more person in those seats. Columbia University's law school calling for state nullification as the correct historical and legal position. I didn't get one person dare to ask me a question. At an Ivy League law school, they don't know what they're doing. So in a way, and that's great for us, you know, but I wish they knew a little bit more and make it more fun.
Yeah, I see exactly what you're saying. Yeah. I will say that every once in a while, I don't want to say pleasantly surprised, but I have occasionally run into really good attorneys who have done their homework. Missouri had a solicitor general some years ago named Jim Layton, and he actually did a lot of work going back, looking at ratifying debates, not only for the federal constitution, but also for Missouri state constitution. And so whenever I would go up against him in court, I knew that we would have a real engagement on a lot of these historical issues. But he's the exception rather than the rule. You're correct. Most attorneys, and especially many law professors, don't spend the time focusing on the philosophical debates that were taking place. They tend to focus only on what the courts have said. And that's just a very small part of the story if you really want to understand the background and the basis for this constitutional system that we've created.
What's the next step for people listening? I mean, obviously, we can't influence the court's decision, but let's say they want to know more about the situation or they want to follow you. Where would you direct them?
Well, the Freedom Center of Missouri's website is mofreedom.org. That's M-O as in Missouri, freedom.org. And so you can follow some of the progress of this particular case and others on our website. I'm on Twitter at Dave_Roland. And I'm also on Facebook. So if people would like to follow the Freedom Center on Facebook or my personal account on Facebook, I post updates on these sorts of issues as we move along. So any of those would be good locations for people who wanted to learn more about the issues and about the work that the Freedom Center is doing. The other thing is there are groups like the Freedom Center of Missouri in about 36 states now. And so if your listeners want to find those groups and support the work that they do, it's crucial that we have principled public interest law firms like the Freedom Center out there fighting for these issues. So if people want to support the work that I'm doing with the Freedom Center, they can go to mofreedom.org/donate and chip in a little bit. We are the most efficient organization of our kind. And so everything that gets contributed goes directly to our work.
Excellent. Okay. I'll put that link up on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/2073. And thanks for your time and your efforts, Dave. They're both appreciated.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, folks, before we wrap up another week of Tom Woods Show episodes, here's a site that will be of interest to some of you. It is a kind of intersectionality of a good kind. It is a Christian preparedness site. So you know what prepping is all about, or rather being a prepper. Well, now combine that with the Christian faith, and you have a website called believerprepared.com. And so you're going to get The Beginner's Guide to Being Prepared, The Three Levels of Situational Awareness, a lot of information that you're going to find useful. So check it out at believerprepared.com. And again, this is a Tom Woods Show listener who created this site. And as I say, I am quite certain there are some folks out there who will be interested in it and benefit from it. So I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/2073. If you want some help promoting your website that you're thinking of starting, before you do a single thing to start that site, get the details of how I can help you at tomwoods.com/publicity. All you got to do is get your hosting through my link, and I'll give you some publicity and also help you in numerous other ways that'll help make your site a success. So the details for how to get all these goodies can be found at tomwoods.com/publicity. I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.